You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Tracy Gerd. I'm with the Strategy Unit, and I lead the New Enterprise Support work. But in a former life, I used to work with JI and work on strategic litigation, doing advocacy around it. So I was absolutely thrilled when Jonathan asked me to moderate this panel. And I feel like there's few guarantees in life, but one thing that I can guarantee is the next 75 minutes will be a fascinating conversation, because we've got two really quite brilliant activists with us today who are going to lead us through their journey that they've taken over the last 4 years, fighting one of the most pernicious legacies of apartheid, which really left a separate and deeply unequal school system, which is reflected in the infrastructure. So in South Africa, Jonathan was just showing me this morning an example of a public school that looks more like a university, with lavish grounds, with quadrangles, with beautiful structures. And as we'll hear about today and see today, that's almost opposite to a lot of the schools that exist in South Africa as a result of apartheid, some being mud structures, for example. So through social mobilization and also strategic litigation, our guests here today have led a journey over the last 4 years where they've had a significant victory that came through last year, which was to get the Minister of Education to issue binding, legally binding norms and standards, minimum norms and standards around the school infrastructure. And so this will really, I mean, it's significant because it will really change the face of schools in South Africa over the coming decade, which is really enormous. So here to tell us about their great victory and how they did it is Brad Brockman, who is the General Secretary of Equal Education. He'll help us understand the history of the campaign, how he and his team actually were really engaged in mobilizing students, parents, community members to really put pressure on the government to achieve this victory, and how they worked together with actually our other guest, who's Dimitri Holtzman, who's the Executive Director of Equal Education's Law Center, who undertook the strategic litigation, actually, and that actually was settled by the minister that led to the issuance of the norms and standards. So they will tell us a little bit about their campaign and the history today. Dimitri will talk about the litigation element and how we work together with Brad. We've got Jim Goldston here also, who's a respondent for us. So as I think everyone knows, Jim has also been a lead figure in international strategic litigation, including on education issues. And I was lucky enough to work with Jim in implementing one of the cases he had won on DH and others versus the Czech Republic, which was about the segregation of Roma children on the basis of ethnicity in the Czech Republic. And we've also got our organizer here, who is Jonathan Fairhead, who is also going to speak to us a little bit about how the Education Support Program sees strategic litigation and the type of work that Dimitri and Brad have been doing as really quite integral to their strategy and some of the lessons you've been learning from that. So we're going to start off today actually with a short video that really sets the scene for the discussion this afternoon. So, Brad, what was striking to me, I think, in that video is the conditions there really highlight how terrible it is for a lot of learners at schools, but these conditions aren't even that unusual for many schools, and in fact, I don't think that's even the worst case scenario for a number of schools. So maybe you could help us understand the history of how schools got to this condition and what led to your campaign over the last 4 years.
Thanks, Tracy. Good afternoon, everyone. I think the first thing that I'd like to say is just with regards to the schools that you saw in the video. Many of those schools, particularly the mud schools, were actually built by black communities themselves during apartheid, when the white apartheid government would not build those schools and would not provide those you know, those facilities for black children. So that was really a community response to a need. And with Bantu education under apartheid, of course, schools were segregated by race, schools were segregated by ethnicity, and there was also a massive disparity in the amount of money which was allocated to the education of the different race groups in South Africa. So, for example, in 1976, the apartheid government was spending 10 rand on the education of every white child, and for every 10 rand, they were spending 1 rand on the education of every black child. So they were spending 10 times as much on the education of white children than they were on black children, and that was reflected in infrastructure, that was reflected in teachers and the quality of teaching within schools, and it was very definitely also reflected in outcomes. Now, the policy of Bantu education was very explicit in its intention. So in 1953, Mr. Hendrik Verwoerd, who at the time was the Minister of Native Affairs, he made this statement in justifying and explaining why Bantu education as a policy was necessary. And he said that there is no place for the Bantu in the European community above the level of certain forms of labor. What is the use of teaching the Bantu child mathematics when it cannot use it in practice? That is quite absurd. Education must train people in accordance with their opportunities in life, according to the sphere in which they live. So it was just a very deliberate attempt, a policy which was institutionalized and implemented for more than 50 years, and that policy really just sought to undermine black education and to, as some would say, to intellectually dispossess black people. And we're dealing today with the legacy of that policy. So within South Africa today, after 1994, schools were no longer segregated by race and by ethnicity. But what we do find is that schools are essentially segregated by class. So most children in South Africa attend public schools, government-funded schools. There's about 25,000 of these public schools. Now, 60% of public schools are not allowed to charge school fees. But 40% of public schools are allowed to charge school fees. And those school fees are set by the parents of the children at that 40% of schools. And essentially, the schools which were built under apartheid and which those years were only available for white children to attend, those schools are now open to everyone, but they are attended by white children and by black middle-class children. And so the disparities in resources, in teachers, in outcome, in school leadership and management still exist, even though legally the system is not designed to do so. Or the intention, or at least the explicit intention of the education system in South Africa is no longer just to oppress black people. But what we do find is a class-based oppression which is linked very closely to race. So essentially, you know, in South Africa, it's sort of accepted that about 75% of our schools are dysfunctional in terms of resources, but also in terms of outcomes. And those schools are located within, you know, poor, still predominantly black communities, and very poor rural areas like you saw in the video. Now, Equal Education, we are, and the organization is essentially a response to this systemic inequality. This inequality which manifests itself in, you know, a massive disparity in resources, but also very importantly in terms of outcomes. So, you know, I know that in America there's a high school dropout rate of probably around 7%. In South Africa we're talking about 50%. Now, if we look at where that 50% is coming from, it's coming from children who are attending, poor black children who are attending these poor and working class schools. And then, you know, when you look at how many students are actually graduating or who are actually graduating with, you know, marks which will enable them to go onto university, it's a very, very small number. So education for most black children in South Africa, poor black children, is not a pathway out of poverty. In fact, it's a poverty trap. It keeps them in the same socioeconomic conditions that their families are in. And so that is a major challenge to the future of South Africa. And it's also a major reason why South Africa remains one of the most unequal, if not the most unequal country in the world. Okay? Now, as Equal Education, we are a grassroots response to this inequality. And the way in which we approach this problem is primarily through community organizing. And what that means is really to organize the people who are most affected by this inequality, which are children who attend schools in townships, which are our version of, you know, project ghettos. I don't know if that's the right terminology I should be using. And rural and very poor rural schools, so those children and their parents. And what we do is that these students and these parents, they become members of the organization. And the organization acts like a vehicle which organizes them in this movement, which shares and educates students and parents about the education system, about inequality within the education system and how it's structured and how it's perpetuated, and also explains to them about the law, about activism and history, and how through coming together, through using research, through using organizing, through using campaigns, through using litigation, one can actually achieve change within individual schools and across the education system. So the organization has been around since 2008. We've started in one of the largest townships in South Africa. It's in Cape Town. It's a place called Khayelitsha. There's about 700,000 to 1 million people who live in this one particular township. More than 50% of the people who live in that township live in informal housing. So that's what we call shacks, which are made out of aluminium and wood. Very, very, you know, poor access to basic services around sanitation, around healthcare, security is also a major issue. And so that's where we started to organize, and that's where our membership base is really formed. And so the students who come and join Equal Education, we engage with them on a weekly basis. We hold meetings, which we call youth group meetings, where students come together and we learn these things, but where we also discuss the issues that are affecting students directly within their schools. And importantly, where we talk about and we plan how students coming together, how they can put pressure on other students, teachers, the district, or the education department as a whole to affect change. And so that's really the model which we use. The types of campaigns that we take up. Initially, when the organization was started in 2008, we took up very local campaigns focused on individual schools, and that's, you know, a principle of organizing is really to start where people are at and to take up the issues that they can understand and that directly affect them and that they want to act to change, and use that as a basis to build sort of a more developed consciousness of educational inequality and what are all the different factors which go into creating this particular system, but start from where people are at. And so we started mainly with issues around infrastructure. So our very first campaign that we took up in 2008 was really just about addressing the fact that at one of the 20 high schools in Khayelitsha, there were 500 broken windows across the school. Okay, and these windows have been broken for many years, and so students would sit in classrooms in winter and rain and the wind, and they would just be completely miserable in these classrooms. And it was very difficult for the students to concentrate, with either when it's hot or when it's cold. And they identified that as an issue that they would like to take up. And then what we did was that we helped the students to do research about this. We helped them also, and we, together with the students, we engaged with government about the issue. They told us, you know, the school is actually scheduled for maintenance, but that's going to happen in 3 years' time. We said we can't wait that long. And we also assisted the students to organize. Other students had to go and have, you know, with petitions to explain to other students, both at their own school and other schools in the area, what was happening. We organized a march to the provincial education department and a picket out there, wrote letters into the media. And eventually we got to a situation where the sort of state or, you know, provincial education minister actually agreed to fix the 500 broken windows and also to, you know, to allocate an additional 700,000 rand. Which is, how much is that, my math?
$70,000,
which is a lot of money, you know, just for to do further upgrades for that particular school. After that, the students, after that victory, which brought a lot of students into the organization within the high schools in Khayelitsha, actually also brought in other students from other townships who heard about this organization that was actually doing something to change the conditions in the school and that was actually winning something. And so it also brought lots of students into the organization. The next campaign that the students identified was around late coming. Okay, and within South Africa, about 20% of students come late to school every day, and about 20% of learning and teaching time is lost due to late coming and absenteeism. And that particular statistic comes from research which was done by an economist at the University of Cape Town. But the students themselves, they experienced it. And in their schools, we're talking about it, I mean, we're not talking about 20% average. You know, in their schools, 50% or more, and teachers are coming late to school, and they could see that that was a real problem, that they were missing out on teaching time, and that, you know, they were not able to cover the curriculum, and they wanted to do something about it. And also importantly for the campaign, it was about really the students saying, it's not only about what we can get from government, it's also about, you know, what we can do to show that we're serious about our education. And so the students with that particular campaign, school starts at 8 o'clock every morning. At 7:30, the members of Equal Education, so let's say 15 to 20 students at all of the high schools in Khayelitsha, they would stand outside the school with placards, they would sing songs, and they would hand out pamphlets to other students, just explain to them about why it's important to come to school on time, but also then saying, you know, as students, like, this is what we can do, this is what we can do better to make sure that we can leave the house early and get to school on time. And so that's really about using, you know, peer pressure, you know, like students applying it to other students. So that was the second campaign that we took on. We've taken up, you know, other smaller campaigns around individual issues in school. So a school where there wasn't a mathematics and science teacher for the final, you know, for the final year students for 4 or 5 months into the year, we took up that particular issue as well. And then in 2009, the organization decided that we'd managed to build up a sizable membership base. We'd managed to build up experience in campaigning, relevant experience, and that we wanted to now attempt something much more broader. And so we took up our first national campaign, which is a campaign for school libraries, which was focused on trying to get the Minister of Basic Education to adopt a policy which would provide for every school to have a library and librarian, even if that's over a 20-year period. Within South Africa, 93% of schools don't have access to stocked libraries. Only 7% of schools have access to these libraries, and the government actually doesn't pay for librarians. It's only schools that have got the money, that have raised money through, you know, parents, that are able to actually pay for libraries and for librarians within schools. And the next big national campaign that we took up, and which Dimitri is going to, you know, take forward the explanation on, is really the campaign for norms and standards. And the video that you saw came out of that particular campaign. It was a tour, a high-profile tour that we organized, which was really just about, you know, at that particular point in the campaign. I mean, the campaign has a long history. We took it up in 2010, we got norms and standards at the end of 2013. That was a particular point where we organized this visit to, you know, elevate the issue into the public much more than it had been. The last thing that I'll say before I pass on to Dimitri is really that, you know, as an organization, we seek through our campaign work, which is based on, and which is really, you know, the foundation of that is the organizing work, the policy work, the research work, which we do in-house as well. You know, we seek to achieve our campaign victories primarily through political means, primarily through organizing, and not through court cases. We see litigation as a last resort, but at the same time, we use litigation very strategically. And for us, it's important that the students who these issues affect and the parents whose children these issues affect, that they are centrally involved in taking up these these issues. And so even when a campaign actually gets to the point of litigation, they are fully aware, they support the decision to move now to litigation, and also that once the campaign reaches a point of litigation, the mobilization doesn't stop. In fact, it intensifies. And so, I mean, that's, we can talk, I'm sure we're going to talk more about just the way in which we combine our organizing and our, you know, mobilization with litigation, but we see the two things as very complementary.
Thank you very much, Brad. I think it's really amazing to hear about the amount of people you've got on board, the powerful constituency that you've got. You also mentioned how the resort to legal action is really your last resort. It's when all other democratic avenues have been exhausted, at least. Can I then turn to Dimitri and say, you know, how did you, as part of the campaign, maybe you can explain a little bit about the Legal Center, and how did you together figure out the point in the campaign where legal action was needed, and can then you explain what the legal action was and what kind of results that you've achieved with it?
Sure. thanks very much, Tracy, and again, good afternoon to everybody. I guess just for starters, it's probably important for me to just clarify something which sometimes it's something that's overlooked, which is that on the particular case and the point at which the litigation was actually initiated on behalf of Equal Education, that was actually done by the Legal Resources Center, which is a different public interest law firm, and which had been working together with us on the campaign for norms and standards for a little while before we actually made the decision to launch the case. In fact, at that time, I was working at Equal Education and the Law Center. At the time, launching the papers for the case had only just really been established. So the Equal Education Law Center, sometimes confused with Equal Education, which in fact was purposeful naming on our part, is a separate legal institution and which is much younger than Equal Education, the organization itself. And in fact, in terms of the kind of linear progression of Equal Education having been started in 2008 and the Law Center only coming about in 2012 is actually in some ways quite instructive and reflective of our general strategy towards litigation in relation to social mobilization, in a sense that, as Brad was describing, it's often, even though we would be, I say we now as Equal Education and the Law Center together, would be building human rights-based campaigns, which, and I'll get to in a moment, the norms and standards case is a good example, which is a political campaign which looks at building social mobilization, but which almost at its fundamental level had, in fact, a legal basis. What we were asking for was norms and standards, which is a set of legal regulations. And so in that sense, you know, as I say, it's descriptive of how it is that we see the role of litigation, in fact, even the role of the Law Center, in some ways as being somewhat subsidiary to the social mobilization work of Equal Education. And often you'll hear, you know, us talking about the fact that the kind of battles that we have to fight in trying to hold the state accountable, we'd much prefer to be able to win that on the streets than in the courts. And it's only at certain points at which you are kind of forced into that situation of saying, well, now it is that we have to consider taking legal action. And I also would like to come back to, you know, some of the, I think, important reasons and principles underlying our perspective on that and why it is that we see litigation as such. Perhaps then to just go to before going to the case, I think something else that's also important is you know, another way of describing the work of Equal Education and the Equal Education Law Center. You know, it's important for us to remind ourselves, I think, that what the purpose of building social mobilization is not to usurp the powers or responsibilities of the state, but fundamentally is actually, it's a question of building social mobilization towards state accountability. So when we're talking about education, we're talking about that as a fundamental human right, which is protected in our constitution, which immediately then means that it is the state which has the primary obligation to actually fulfill that. What Equal Education is then doing is using democratic processes, including rights to mass mobilization, to demonstration, to the rights to engage with parliament in the lawmaking and public accountability or state accountability oversight mechanisms and ultimately also litigation in the courts, all being these avenues which are in essence provided to civil society and the public, within which to then hold the state to account. And so, again, just back to the original point, litigation is one of those democratic processes and tools that we use in ultimately holding the state to account to ensure that it provides a decent and adequate public education on an equitable basis. And that's, again, brings me to the next point, which is also that, you know, while there is quite a specific moment, even in the norms and standards case as an example, where it is that we have to decide now that the campaign has got to the point at which we have to actually take it to court. You know, it's as I was saying earlier on, it's not that that's the only point at which litigation or the legal mechanisms come into play. It's a stage at which we move then into something quite specific, but ultimately there is almost always an interaction between use of the law and the social mobilization aspect. So then perhaps to just give as brief an overview of what transpired in the Norms and Standards campaign and the point at which it then, as I say, it's not necessarily a separation, but we kind of had to move into a phase of litigation, was ultimately after the realization that the campaign and the engagement that had been happening between Equal Education, the Equal Education members and the Minister of Education had reached a point at which it seemed that there was no more constructive engagement that was actually happening. In fact, the basis of the decision ultimately to say now is that we actually have to litigate to force the minister's hand was at a point at which she turned around to say, in fact, norms and standards for school infrastructure as regulations is not what I need to do in order to address this problem. What we're going to adopt instead are going to be non-binding guidelines for school infrastructure. I've taken us all the way to the point at which we decided that litigation was then going to be important. That was really a turning point. But to take a few steps back, up until that point, the engagement with the minister was that, the objectives of the Norms and Standards campaign was actually based on the fact that the state had already begun the process of adopting norms and standards and adopting a policy. These were both two documents. One was a draft policy on school infrastructure, and the other was a draft set of norms and standards for school infrastructure. Those were actually adopted by the previous Minister of Education in 2008. The background to that is actually that in 2007, Parliament had amended the main piece of legislation which regulates schooling in South Africa. And it basically, in that amendment, given the Minister of Education the power to adopt minimum norms and standards. In essence, Parliament was saying to the Minister, the right to education, we understand from Parliament's perspective that one of the elements of providing for the right to education is to ensure that there is adequate school infrastructure. It was clear that Parliament's recognition was then that the Minister should, in order to address the infrastructure backlogs, adopt a set of these regulations that would be binding on the state and that would, as I say, apply to all schools across the country and deal with every element of school infrastructure. So in essence, the law said this. It said the Minister of Education may adopt minimum norms and standards for school infrastructure, and if he or she does, those regulations must provide for, at the very least, and it provided a list of about 7 or 8 elements of school infrastructure that would be seen as fundamental to any school environment. It said that it must provide for water, electricity, sanitation, fencing, and then also included things like science laboratories, computer labs, and school libraries. So it was quite a clear direction to the minister that if she was going to adopt these standards, these would be the things that would have to be accounted for in those standards. It then later on also re-amended that section to say that the minister would actually, in adopting those standards, would have to do so after consultation with the Minister of Finance. Obviously of the recognition that any standards that would have to be met would obviously require resources, which would ultimately have to be allocated, initially at least, from the Minister of Finance. The interesting thing then is that you have these draft regulations that are sitting around collecting dust in essence, and we don't actually know what happened between 2008 when those draft regulations, which in fact were very comprehensive and became in fact the basis, Brad was mentioning the school libraries campaign, when he spoke about equal education actually having developed a draft policy for school libraries, we based that and we even designed architecture, we got architects to design what a standard library should look like as part of a policy on the basis of the draft regulations which the government itself had actually, as I say, initiated. So in fact, quite simply to sum up what the campaign was actually about was to say to the Minister of Education, please follow through with what it is that you've already done. In other words, just make sure that those laws ultimately get passed. The reason that's important, I think, also, it goes back to the question of state accountability as being, I think, one of the central features of what it is that Equal Education and the Equal Education Law Centre are doing, which is to hold the state accountable. And one of the ways in which we can do so is to base the objectives of a campaign or what it is that we would be requesting from government on what it is that exists in law or in policy. So in essence, that was we've always seen, for example, the school infrastructure campaign, and it's been called the minimum norms and standards for school infrastructure. The first objective of that was to simply say we need that law to be passed, because that in itself, the law is now passed. It hasn't necessarily meant that there's been an immediate change to the school infrastructure environment across the country, but it now gives us a legal basis upon which to continue to hold the government accountable in the way in which it actually develops its plan for school infrastructure and actually implements that over a number of years. And I think that's, again, an important point about why it is that we were asking for norms and standards rather than going to the court, rather than ultimately going to court and saying we want the Department of Education to fix all schools. And that's what made it more a systemic case rather than, you know, looking at things on a more individual level. And importantly, it was setting up the basis for accountability in a systemic way that really only lays the foundation for all the work that's going to have to go into making sure that that law now gets implemented. So in essence, what was happening, the minister actually up until that point was saying, yes, we're going to give you the norms and standards. And in fact, there was a number of deadlines which she herself had actually set to adopt those standards. Equal Education was campaigning heavily around that. In fact, one of the most significant milestones in the campaign was a march of 20,000 learners to Parliament on Human Rights Day to simply remind the minister that her deadline was coming up to adopt these norms and standards, and that they were ready to welcome the adoption of these standards. It's important to say that the minister actually chose not to attend that march, which is most likely the biggest youth march in South Africa post 1994. And I think it was also in itself reflective of what the attitude of government towards the increasing relevance and noise that Equal Education was actually making around this. You know, something that I think is just a small anecdote. I remember having a meeting while we're still doing the libraries campaign. And we'd identified these draft regulations that were collecting dust, as I was saying. I was meeting with quite a high official in the education department, where I was told quite directly, saying that she said to me, "You know, do you know why it is we won't give you these norms and standards?" And I said, "No, I don't know why." She says, "Because the moment we adopt these norms and standards, you're going to take those very norms and standards and run off to court to sue us because we're not actually achieving them." And I think it was quite an interesting point to note, because we're saying, "Why is it that you won't do it? Just do what it is that you were doing." When those norms and standards were initially adopted. Drafted, Equal Education wasn't even in existence. And I think there was an immediate realization of the power that a set of regulations like that would provide to civil society in holding the state accountable, which they were, I think, quite fearful of. In any case, what then ultimately developed into a string of broken promises by the Minister of Education, she and even at this point, I must say that there was discussions about whether or not there'd be a strong case to bring against the minister to actually compel her to adopt those norms and standards. But it was only at a point at which she then did a 180 degree turn, and suddenly, after she'd been promising Parliament, she'd been promising us, the draft was almost ready, they'd now got concurrence from the Minister of Finance in terms of the Act, and she suddenly turned around and said no. She wrote a letter to Equal Education saying, in fact, the law does not compel me to adopt regulations, so instead I'm choosing to adopt guidelines for school infrastructure, which for us was fell far short of what it is that we would expect, and guidelines can change anytime they want. I mean, it's a suggestion rather than a legally binding standard. And it was really at that point that the decision was then made to say, look, there's no point in further engaging on this level, and the minister's made quite a clear position on the status of those norms and standards. So that was at the end of 2011. We then, as Equal Education, as I said, 2011, the Law Centre was actually, we were preparing to actually establish the Law Centre at that point. And what we did, I'm just going to give in my last 2 minutes a quick description of the actual, the way in which we crafted the case, which I think is also just quite important in terms of what our approach to it was. What we then did was, even though it was almost quite clear cut that the power was there for the minister to use, there'd been a series of acknowledgements by the Education Department, by Parliament, that the best way to deal on a national level with the massive infrastructure backlogs is the first step in that would be to adopt minimum norms and standards. Then we came along and they were saying, actually, no, we don't need to do that anymore. We're going to go against everything that we've just described numerous times before. But even though that would have seemed like quite a clear-cut case, we used the court case, in fact, as another step in the campaign in itself. One of the dangers, I think, that you face when deciding to take a campaign case to court is that you then get a process pretty much stuck in the court system. So, I mean, it again goes also back to one of the reasons why you have to be quite careful, I think, about when it is that you choose to take on strategic litigation, because you in essence are now taking away a certain space within which to engage and ultimately getting potentially stuck in what could be quite a long, drawn-out court process, which I think is again, a caution to any of us when making these decisions. But we used the case and the founding affidavit, for example, firstly as a record of the entire process of engagement that had happened over the years before. And so even the legal process in itself became a political tool. It's slightly unorthodox for us to have gone into so much detail as to how many times we'd written to the minister, how many times she'd promised. We'd collected expert evidence which made sure that there was a clear link between, or that demonstrated the clear link between school infrastructure and the right to basic education, which is one of the things that the minister ironically responded to in saying, but look, I mean, at some point people were saying things like, look, you can find these schools under a tree. Why is it that infrastructure is necessary for a schooling, a proper schooling environment? But thirdly, we also then went around, we visited 7 provinces. Our initial target, I'll never forget, was to try and get 100 affidavits from schools all across the country. So from principals, teachers and parents describing the effect of poor infrastructure on their ability to actually, effect proper schooling. We ended up with just over 20 affidavits from different schools, which all described different ways in which sanitation or the lack of electricity actually had an effect on their schooling environment. And in that way, it was a way to say, this is not just an abstract campaign. We're not just asking for an abstract set of laws at this high national level. We want to show that these are people's stories, that and this is the direct and severe consequences of the lack of proper planning and proper regulation at the top. I'm going to stop now because I think I'm going on a bit long, but just to say that what we did was to the respondents in the case, the applicants in the case first were 2 schools in the Eastern Cape, which were, there were schools that represented, I think one of them was in the video, might not have been. Anyway, but there were schools that represented the kind of worst off in relation to school infrastructure. And so those were 2 applicants that, again, would bring the real direct and immediate story. And that also allowed for us to bring the case on an urgent basis, because these were schools that not only, you know, they didn't just need norms and standards, they needed immediate and urgent relief. But we were able to then attach the court case, the emergency relief aspect for those two schools, to the bigger, more systemic issue. And in that way, also make sure that we could bring the bigger case in together with the smaller, more emergency case, so to speak. Equal Education was then also an applicant, which again is also a strategy that gets used in the strategic litigation to ensure that we don't bring the case on behalf of two schools, saying that they need this emergency relief and norms and standards, and the department comes back and says, okay, don't worry, we'll settle this case out of court, we'll fix those two schools, and the rest of the bigger issue kind of falls away. Equal Education as an institutional body then allows for, even if there is the basis for a settlement agreement on those two applicants, there would still be a cause of action that we can follow through with on the bigger institutional level. And the respondents in the case were the Minister of Education, the Minister of Finance, and all nine provincial ministers of education. Last point, I'll end on this. The interesting thing about all of this was that one of the interesting things about the case, which was a bit baffling in many ways, was that we were asking for the minister, who sits at the top, she's the national minister, her main responsibility is to set standards and policies that must then be implemented by the provincial ministers of education. So if anything, they've got the most difficult job. She can set the standard over here, and they are then required to actually be implementing that in each of the provinces. And yet the minister was resisting this action. We were saying, look, I mean, once you adopt those standards, our attention will then actually shift away from you to the provinces, and the pressure will really be put on them to implement. At some points there was, I'm pretty sure the minister was actually telling us that there was resistance from those from the provincial MECs, which was, you know, finally undermined when we did file court papers. We filed against all of them, and the only respondent that actually filed notice to defend the case was the national minister. All the provincial MECs actually filed notice to say we would abide by whatever the court's decision actually is. And I think that was also quite an interesting, in the legal, you know, once we moved into the process of litigation, it was quite an interesting change and turn. Ultimately, 3 days before court, after the minister had in fact filed notice of intention to defend, they'd filed answering papers with extremely weak legal arguments, quite embarrassing legal arguments, I'd actually say. And yeah, we were preparing to go to court, and I mean, we can come back to that in a moment, but just to say it was important that in that process, the campaigning never stopped. Equal Education even held a picket after the minister failed to meet the deadline to reply to the court papers. Equal Education had a picket outside Parliament, for example, to just remind the minister that your papers are due, and in fact, we've given you an extension. So there was this constant engagement and political and social mobilization happening quite alongside the litigation strategy. Needless to say, the case was settled out of court. The minister agreed to adopt norms and standards. And since then, we've had two drafts, the first of which was absolutely, of a nice thing to say. It was just embarrassing. It was an 8-page document which basically had no standards in it at all. Equal Education then organized for public hearings where we would got input from the public about what their reflections on those were, made submissions to the minister again. Another set of regulations were adopted, slightly better this time. Public comment ensued after that, and ultimately we very recently got pretty decent, I'd say, norms and standards for school infrastructure. And I'll stop there for now, if that's okay.
No, that's fantastic. As someone who used to work on advocacy, implementing these decisions, I can really speak to how amazing it is that you were able to get such a level of mobilization of people and achieve this really important legal victory in the space of 4 years. And I think, and maybe we can get into this in the discussion time, but I think the level, we haven't even got into the level of sophistication of the campaign, which was really, truly inspiring to me. I mean, it included social media, masked marches, right, where they put masks, the students put on the masks of the minister's face as part of it. There was a big balloon that you told me about when she didn't turn up somewhere, and so they had her as a balloon there and its presence.
We had a replica minister.
Yeah, there was going to be a camp outside of the High Court to stage debates and discussions while the hearing was supposed to take place. So it was a very, very sophisticated and creative campaign that went alongside and hand in hand with the legal case, which I thought was just absolutely brilliant. And I think now, actually turning to us, thinking about OSF, I wanted to turn to you first, Jonathan, and say, you know, this is a really interesting way of promoting social change, using strategic litigation and social mobilization. I wonder if you could speak about why the Education Support Program, as a donor, decided to support this particular tool, this methodology for trying to achieve the outcomes that you're looking for in your strategy.
Absolutely. You know, it's an interesting answer to that question, and our relationship with EE has grown organically over time, starting, you know, in quite sort of small initial support and engagement, and then we've really sort of grown and learnt together. So there's no sort of direct answer. We didn't really set out knowing what EE was going to become or what EE was going to do. I have a line here that I just sort of, I was glancing at our current strategy this morning, it just sort of shows how, at least in the time that I've been with ESP, you know, our thinking has grown with EE. And, you know, currently ESP supports social mobilization to demand accountability and the use of strategic litigation where feasible and where other tools are used. A lot of our current thinking around strategic litigation in education has been informed by our relationship with EE. And, you know, and our thinking is still very much that litigation is strategic when it builds on the will of the people and comes out of the social movement. So for ESP, it's strategic litigation only when it's connected to a social movement. And therefore ESP doesn't see litigation as a replacement for the political process. I think that, you know, what's especially relevant for ESP is the fact that in the EE case, the social movement is leading the charge. The lawyers report not only to EE, but to their members and to the youth who they meet with on a weekly basis at their office in Khayelitsha and across the country in these sort of education camps, which inform the young people about their rights, the history of the struggle in South Africa, which is lengthy, the role, the place of this current struggle for education justice within that struggle. And then there's a conversation develops between school learners in South Africa, but between schoolgoers. EE schoolgoers at other schools, and then those channels can go all the way up through the lawyers to the minister and the courts. So I think that's especially important to us. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And Jim, how about you? So for Justice Initiative, strategic litigation is part of our, I use the royal we, I still count myself as JI, is part of JI's bread and butter. I'm curious what your reflections were as you listened to Brad and Dimitri. Are there lessons for JI? Are there productive exchanges? Are there other issues that emerged for you as someone who's been a long-term litigator in the education space? What were the resonant points for you that came out of this discussion?
Thanks, Tracy. Well, first of all, I mean, I just, the most resonant point is how impressed one is by seeing the sophisticated thinking and translating that thinking into action about how to pursue an initiative such as this. And I was trying to think about, building on the informal conversation we had yesterday, what had been the ingredients of the success to date, anyway, in the campaign that Brad and Dimitri and others have led. So one, of course, we've got, as we've talked about, a community-based campaign with many members drawn from the community themselves. Brad talked about students and their parents who were themselves part of this effort. As we just said, it's a campaign which thinks in a very sophisticated fashion about its own role and the interconnections among various kinds of advocacy and litigation which it's pursuing. It's a campaign which seems at least relatively well-resourced, and that's important and not trivial, recognizing, of course, I'm sure they could use more, but they've got some resources to work with. I this is a question, but I assume as well, and I'm interested to hear more about, you know, the fact that this campaign exists today in South Africa, 20 years after the end of a historic struggle against apartheid, and one always thinks about South Africa as the richness of its civil society, which is in many ways the benefit of that struggle against apartheid. So to what extent this campaign is informed by the struggle, the lessons of that struggle, the losses of that struggle, etc., I don't know. We also have other ingredients of success. South Africa is a society, whatever its flaws and its challenges, with a relatively strong culture of respect for the rule of law and for courts. So litigation is significant in that context. It means something in that context. The courts are on the whole independent. The judges are on the whole capable and knowledgeable, and you can present fact-based arguments and appreciate that they'll be heard and considered. As Dimitri said yesterday, the South African Constitution is world-renowned as one of the strongest and most progressive and detailed in terms of its delineation of rights that exists today, so that's a very useful tool. South Africa has a large pool of highly capable lawyers upon whom it is the struggle can draw. Obviously, there are resource issues there, but there's a huge human resource pool. And I was surprised to hear, and please correct me if I'm wrong, yesterday, that the colleagues in the campaign believe that the government, whatever its resistance, its lagging, its delays, is on the whole relatively supportive of the aims of the campaign. And that matters a lot. Those are a lot of distinctive factors, it seems to me, and I'm sure there are many others that are significant. And I started to think about this in comparison with some of the struggles that we've been involved in. So one, of course, is the situation in Central and Eastern Europe around access to education. And there, you know, in the Czech Republic, in Hungary, in Greece, in Romania, in Croatia, not many of these factors are present. You do have a solid legal framework, often at the national or constitutional level, not as great as the South African Constitution, but they generally do the right things, and the European legal framework, which is very strong. And you've got courts that are at least formally independent, but, activism for educational equality is generally not undertaken by broad-based community organizations like this, at least that I'm interested to hear what colleagues have to say, but my sense is it's largely in the hands of a relatively narrow elite that often has tenuous ties to small segments of the communities at issue, and there's relatively limited community engagement, at least particularly on issues that I'm most familiar with when it concerns the Roma. There has been activity at the highest levels in generating rhetorical commitment among governments and European regional bodies, but with some exceptions, there's been relatively little grassroots organizing among affected minority communities themselves, if anything approaching this kind. The number of lawyers in these countries who are willing to devote themselves to these efforts is far smaller by comparison. The quality of national courts itself is mixed. And though the quality of the regional courts, the European Court of Human Rights and the Court of Justice of the European Union, is high, the place of those institutions and their impact on national discussions is very uncertain and sometimes quite limited. So as a result, 17 years after Roma rights advocates started various kinds of initiatives for educational equality, they've won some landmark victories. They've gotten some nice national policy declarations. And they've gotten some pilot initiatives that have achieved some change, but on the whole, most Roma are not in a different place in terms of their educational quality today than they were 15, 17 years ago. And then you've got the United States, where many of the factors that exist in South Africa are present. You've got very active communities, you've got very independent, very capable courts on the whole. You have in principle, though it's varied over time, a government commitment formally to educational quality and equality. And yet, the struggle for educational quality in the United States has as yet failed to achieve either of the two aims that were sought by those who brought Brown v. Board of Education 60 years ago, either integrated education or quality education for everyone. In respect of racial integration, the high point was reached in the 1980s, and it's regressed since. We've had significant resegregation in the last 25 years in this country, right? And in terms of quality, we've seen how hard it is to secure quality education for everyone. Just if we look in New York State, landmark litigation 10 years ago won a ruling that said that all children are entitled to a sound basic education in New York State. And the court not only did that, they ordered that the state spend almost $2 billion a year more to educate kids. But translating that court ruling, detailed and powerful as it was, into reality has been hard. Since then, we've had a recession. And the legislature and the governor over two administrations has been relatively mixed so that the funding hasn't really come through. So I'm left with an appreciation, one, on the extraordinary challenge of securing educational quality for everyone. Secondly, as I said, the incredible respect and esteem that I've got for Brad and Dimitri and the colleagues they're working with. Third, I guess it makes me wonder, given the long-term nature of this struggle, how those in South Africa are thinking about maintaining political commitment to funding this over the long term. And then finally, we talked a little bit about yesterday, if there's any time, what's the role of race in the struggle for equal education in South Africa today? In the U.S., the initial approach 60 years ago was very much about race, and that's been much criticized since as perhaps a lost opportunity. In Europe, advocates for the Roma and for persons with disabilities have struggled, sometimes together, sometimes apart, for inclusion in mainstream schools, in part because they say segregation itself is dangerous, and in part because that improves quality. In South Africa, so these materials, and I haven't, you will know best, they don't reference race as much as class, it seems to me. And I wonder, is that conscious? Does that reflect the reality? I'd be curious just to know how race and class play out in terms of the struggle that you're fighting. But again, just incredible respect for what you're doing.
Thank you, Jim. And maybe before we go to Dimitri and Brad to address some of those questions, we might actually open it up, I think, to people here, because I'm sure this conversation has prompted a lot of questions and thinking about what's been achieved in South Africa. And I think Jim just brought in a beautiful counterpoint, just reminding us how difficult it is in some other contexts, and how the legal, political, and community context can really play a role in how successful different tactics can be, including strategic litigation, in achieving change. So I think we've got a lot of food for thought here. I just want to open it up to people here, and also to our lovely colleagues in London who are sitting there late in the evening for us, so looking very relaxed. please jump in if you have questions too. So just opening it up now. Yes.
Hi, I'm Aisha. I work at the Economic Development Fund on the 9th floor, just joined last week. So what I'm interested in knowing is, what are the takeaways for countries where the litigation and the law is not so strong, so you cannot really, approach it from this angle, but the quality of education and the access to education is very poor. So from your experience working on this, what are the lessons that can be applied in other places?
Good afternoon, Alicia Taylor. I work with Jonathan in the Education Support Program, and similar to your question, I just wanted to, what extent has the example of EE and the Law Center sort of inspired similar movements or activism in either in neighboring countries or in other parts of South Africa where you aren't active?
Hi, all. This is Mark Kropansky from Justice Initiative, currently calling from Barcelona. Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation. I found it fascinating. My question for Brad and Dimitri is if you, I'm curious because the litigation really came out of a popular mass-based campaign strategy. And I'm wondering if you can speak to how, you know, litigation can often be alienating or isolating for broad grassroots memberships. And I'm wondering if you can speak to how you try to engage your membership in the litigation, or how you try to bring the litigation to the people, in other words.
I just want to start maybe with trying to answer Mark's question. Look, Mark, I think, you know, with us, we made a very conscious effort to keep our members involved and to give them a say in terms of the campaign, including when we decided to actually to go to court. So by the time we actually made the decision to go to court, we'd actually been campaigning for about 2 years. And by that time, you know, our members were ready and they agreed and they felt that it's time now to take the minister to court. But what's also interesting is that at different stages within the campaign, and when one stage in particular, after the minister had disappointed us, you know, numerous times and reneged on all sorts of promises, you know, in the middle of 2013, she asked for an extension. Okay? She asked for an extension to adopt norms and standards, and we took that to the membership, and we asked the membership how they felt about that particular request, and overwhelmingly they said that we shouldn't give the minister an extension. Now, as the leadership of the organization, you know, we consulted with them, but in actual fact we decided to give the minister an extension, but to give a limited extension. And we did that because on the one end we were informed by what the members felt, but also we felt very strongly together with our lawyers. We felt that if we didn't give this minister this extension, and the matter were to go to court, the judges may be very sympathetic to what the minister was saying and see what she was saying as quite reasonable, and we might even get into a situation where the judge gives a much longer extension than we would have, you know, given her and agreed to in the first place. So that created a lot of, you know, tension within the organization. I'll, you know, be frank about that. But it was important for us to consult, and it was also important for us afterwards to explain our particular choice. And in the end, I think we made the right choice with that. Just in terms of race and class within the struggle, you know, as I said, at the moment in South Africa, if you've got the money, whether you're black or you're white, and you can afford to actually pay for a good quality education, you can access that. Now, the children of politicians, the children of civil servants, you know, the children of the black middle class are going to schools which are well resourced and which are, you know, performing well. And so in terms of our advocacy, that's a very interesting dynamic. And so the members who are members of Equal Education, they are predominantly black and poor. Okay, and so we have to, the issue of class has to feature within our politics. Race as well, because all the children that are poor are essentially black. So race does feature, and there is a link. But, you know, sometimes the education department and those who are critics try and use race against us in, you know, very pernicious ways. And so, for example, after, you know, we had staged mass marches across the country in the middle of 2013, the minister very publicly attacked Equal Education and said Equal Education is a group of white adults that is organizing black African children with half-truth, and that this is dishonest, and and so we had to, you know, we had to be able to counter that, and we got a lot of support, and that was, you know, we got a lot of support from our members, from their parents, from other people, and saying that it was a clear attempt that the minister was trying to use race in a very negative way, because our organization is non-racial. We are building solidarity across racial and across class lines as well, but, you know, our membership base is very clear, and the leadership of the organization represents a demographic of those who are oppressed, still continue to be so. And I think I'm going to stop there because you did say 3 minutes, and I'll hand over to you.
Thank you, Dimitri. You're going to send us out with a bang, aren't you?
Sure, yeah. I'll try, no pressure. Okay, I mean, actually, unfortunately, two of the questions are quite direct, and I feel they're very difficult to answer. You know, Jim was mentioning one of the major advantages that we have in South Africa as being, you know, this very progressive constitution. In fact, quite extensive laws that frame the rights in education specifically. I'm not quite sure what the answer is to what you do where you don't have that kind of environment, other than perhaps to suggest that, you know, those be the starting blocks or aims to which either litigation or social mobilization would actually move towards, is to push for development and securing of certain, in a sense, kind of the details of rights through policy and legislation, because that gives you some backstop, you know, which we're in, outside South Africa, in a fortunate position that we don't actually have to be fighting for, from a legal perspective, those basic guards. So, I mean, my answer is I don't know what you do in a different situation. Unfortunately, my experience particularly is only in an environment where those tools are actually accessible. To Alicia's comment, I mean, I thought Brad was maybe going to have a go at that. I don't know. I don't know whether we, you know, whether we've inspired other people to be able to take up similar type struggles.
We can say we've been inspired by other examples.
Exactly, and that's, thank you. I was going to say just that, actually. Most definitely. I think I wanted to also speak to Mark's question, but also to go to something which Jim raised. Mark was asking about how it is that we ensure that the kind of legal aspects don't alienate members, which I think is a very important question. And in some ways, to answer that in a way where I'll speak about what the Law Centre, you know, one of the reasons we started the Law Centre was because, amongst others, we recognize the importance of lawyers working very closely with the activists, with the members of the organization, so that firstly, even in our thinking, we are not, you know, seen as separate, or that we come in to save the day when we need to go to court. We've got to see ourselves, in a sense, as being part of that movement. And understanding that our role is not only to just be there to go to court. We try to constantly be engaged with equal education. So we would go to some of the youth groups, for example, and if there's, I mean, recently we've had an incident where we've had trouble during a demonstration. Equal education was confronted in a way by the police, which had a direct implication, not necessarily on education rights specifically, but on the Gatherings Act, which regulates the way in which demonstrations are meant to be held. And so we would have our lawyers going out to youth groups now to make sure that there's workshopping and training around what the law says around that, and similarly for questions like norms and standards. You know, no, we talk about the norms and standards for school infrastructure campaign. It's got to be of the most boring names ever. But never mind what's in the actual policies. Okay. So, and again, that's something that we have to feel that members need to be fully on top of. They need to understand what it is that we're ultimately going to go to court for. And so we're not just a legal institution waiting for court, you know, court proceedings to be initiated. We're constantly engaged in the even political education work that Equal Education is doing with its members. And so I think that is one way in which, so I'm trying to look up because Mark is just somewhere in the scene.
thank you.
But secondly, I think another very interesting question, which is, and it relates again to something Mark was saying, but also again to a point that Jim raised, which I think is something that I find at least to be quite unique about litigating the right to education, which is that it has a complexity, I feel, which is unique to that right that you don't really find in other socioeconomic rights. What is it that the state must do in order to provide a decent education? Can anybody give me the full and comprehensive list, and then create a set of legal standards which describe that and which we can then enforce? yes, we can get to those points, but it's very difficult. And in fact, there would be, you know, differences in opinion even within education fields about what the top five priorities are, for example, in ensuring that the right is in fact fulfilled. That brings immediate challenges when you talk about separation of powers. Do we then go and ask a judge to say that you must order that, funding alone should be increased for a particular school or for a particular state, and will that necessarily mean that there will be advances around the right to education? That complexity, I think, is both, it's important to recognize. I think it can be both limiting, but it's also something that we have to be cognizant of as litigators around the right to education. Let us not pretend that a judge is better suited to answer what a strategy to improve an education system is better than an education minister. But what we can do, and this goes back to what Jim's question is about, which was the question of alienation. If I had time, I'm not going to go into it, but you'll see that we've got annual reports of the Law Center on the table. In there, you'll see a description of a particular case which we've taken on, which I think is, you know, it's a newer case, it's much more difficult because it deals with a school that has almost all the problems you can possibly imagine a school having. Drunk teachers, a principal that was absent for 9 months, textbooks from 1986, overcrowded classrooms, and ultimately the main legal question that we're looking at is why is it that the state, in other words the education department, is not actually providing additional support and oversight to that school to get it out of that situation. Even in answering that question, it's complex. We don't know what the answer is. But what we've done through the litigation, and what I think is going to be an increasing strategy that we want to take on, is to say that there's clearly, we describe what the facts are, which is the terrible circumstances of the school. The major question that we're looking at goes back to what I was saying about the state ultimately being accountable towards these schools and providing for the right to education and assisting the school in getting out of that situation. There's been a complete sense of neglect from the state. The way in which we got the case was high school learners thinking they were calling the education department and somehow got one of our colleagues from Equal Education on the phone to say that we need some help from somewhere. They then said, it's one of our colleagues, he said, look, write us a letter and describe what's going on. And you'll see the letter, we've printed it in there itself. There's a desperate plea for some kind of help. And the one of the things that strikes you is that against this backdrop, there's not even the decency of a response from the Department of Education. Now, that's a worse alienation. And to Mark's, to come at Mark's question from a flip side, we've used the litigation to now say, we don't want to give you the answers of what it is that you need to do in order to get that school out of the situation, but we've litigated and asked for a structural interdict that would force the department to come and respond to the community, to say to them, okay, we've identified these are the problems, this is what we're going to do, and in terms of the court order, they must now come and report back up until the point at which that school actually improves. And in that way, the litigation is actually ensuring that there isn't, in fact, an alienation. It's providing a kind of legal covering and environment within which the state is then forced to not only address the problems, but to do so in a way which consults with those that are affected. And in a sense, it allows for, in fact, it's a space within which Equal Education is assisting in organizing the community around the objectives of the court order. And is almost a flip side of what we've been talking about. So my bang is to say, basically, that I don't think that there is a simple answer or model to the way in which strategic litigation and social mobilization must happen. And I think the point was made earlier is that it does require a kind of ongoing reflection, ongoing changing of strategy, prodding the state at parliament side and then at the Minister of Education and sometimes deciding to go to court. But I do think that one of the key things that we've learned, which is why I guess you've asked Equal Education and the Equal Education Law Center to speak, is that we don't see ourselves as separate, as adopting separate strategies. We've set up the Law Center as an extension of Equal Education specifically so that there can be this ongoing engagement between the legal and social mobilization strategies, so to speak, and that the two are often one in and of the same thing.
That's actually the perfect bang to go out on. So thank you so much for that, Dimitri. Thank you, everyone, for coming and joining with us. I think if you're the same as me, I feel like I wish I had hours more to actually engage and learn more about the work. But thank you so much, Dimitri and Brad, for sharing with us what you've done. It's really a remarkable achievement. Thank you, Jonathan, for setting this up and organizing it. It's really great to hear your thoughts and how they fit into your strategy. And thank you so much, Jim, for joining us and giving us that international perspective. So, and it's great to have the disembodied voice too, Mark. Thank you so much, everyone. Oh, thank you, London, too.